The Trump impeachment, number two, that is our topic right now, and some other constitutional questions with John Eidsmo, our guest. I'm Jerry Newcomb. This is Vocal Point. And John Eidsmo is a law professor and also the author of some very important books about law, and also the author of the classic book, Christianity and the Constitution. And John Eidsmo, I was tempted to just say at the very opening, we're going to talk about the Trump impeachment sham, but maybe that would show my hand too much. But what are your thoughts on Trump impeachment number two?
It would certainly show my hand that this is purely a fraud. First of all, there's no basis for it. They're claiming that he instigated this riot that took place in the Capitol. And in fact, when the speech that he gave there that morning, he urged his supporters to march over to the Capitol building to, quote, peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard. Now, that's not inflammatory. And not only that, but the violence and the lawlessness that took place there, that actually started about 20 minutes before he was finished with his speech. It's not clear that those who engaged in the break-in even heard his speech. And besides that, then when Trump became aware of what was going on, he sent a tweet urging his people to go home. So there's no way that he can be guilty of instigating what took place in the Capitol on January 6th. Not only that, but we note the hypocrisy of the Democratic establishment here and a few Republican allies as they condemn this, and yet they have been silent about the lawlessness, the break-ins, the looting, the pillaging, the shooting, the beatings, and the murders that took place over the summer on almost a daily basis in many left-controlled cities. So, again, there's hypocrisy here, and there's no basis for this. In fact, also, I'd say there's no basis for this in law. Now, as far as having jurisdiction over President Trump, arguably the House did because he was still in office at the time, although to impeach somebody who is going to be out of office within a week still seems to be the height of foolishness and a waste of time and money. And not only that, but there's a rush to judgment. At the time they did that, the people who were involved in the rioting had not even been charged. The investigations were not even complete. And in the House, of course, this was all conducted without giving Trump a lawyer, without calling a single witness, and it was nothing but a lynch mob mentality. But then it goes over to the Senate, and by the time the Senate will take this up, Trump will have already been out of office for several weeks. And as far as whether the Senate has jurisdiction to act after the person that they seek to remove is out of office, well, there are a couple of precedents back and forth on that. One goes back to 1797 when a senator had been impeached by the House. Before the Senate took it up, he had already been expelled from the Senate. And so the Senate decided that there was no jurisdiction to proceed further. And I think that's probably important because that's only 8 years after the Constitution was ratified. So I suspect probably that particular Senate had a pretty good idea of the intent of the framers.
Because they were the framers.
Many of them probably were. I'd have to check that. But I would guess that many of those senators had been at the Constitutional Convention. But then we go to 1876, and here's a case where a Secretary of War was ready to be impeached by the House. About 2 hours before the vote on impeachment was to take place, he resigned. The House simply said that he had resigned solely for the purpose of evading impeachment, so they went ahead and impeached him. It then went to the Senate, and the Senate decided that they had jurisdiction to hear the case, but they fell short of the two-thirds to convict or take any action. But anyway, so I would certainly say that this is an exercise in futility. It's being done solely to try to prevent President Trump from running for office again. But here's the hypocrisy of this once again. They're doing this in the name of democracy. And yet, in the name of democracy, they would not only preclude him from running again, but they would preclude some 73 million Americans from voting for the candidate of their choice. This, again, is hypocrisy.
Who was the senator that was impeached from 1799? I'm just curious. Do you remember
the name? His name is William Blount, B-L-O-U-N-T, of Tennessee.
Blount. Huh, interesting.
And Secretary of War in 1876 was William Belknap, B-E-L-K-N-A-P.
Okay. Did President Trump receive due process in the House of Representatives a couple weeks ago?
Well, in my opinion, he certainly did not. And again, the Constitution is not specific about how the House is to conduct its proceedings, but every impeachment that has ever took place that I'm aware of, whether for a president or for a federal judge or another officer of the federal government, they have looked at the evidence, they have called witnesses, they have engaged in extensive debate, they have listened to argumentation from lawyers on both sides. They didn't do this here. They conducted this in just a matter of a few hours, and it was impassioned speeches, hypocritical speeches, I might add. So, no, this was not due process by any stretch of the imagination.
Okay, I understand that one of the persons involved in the upcoming, well, this is being recorded on Friday afternoon, February 5. It will air later, possibly even after the impeachment trial, but still the constitutional issues at stake are worth exploring here. They sent a letter saying, we want Trump to appear before the Senate, you know, to make a statement or whatever, to be on trial, if you will. And the president's attorney, David L. Schoen, or David I. Schoen, and Bruce Castor in Schoen's office wrote a letter saying this, quote, we are in receipt of your latest public relations stunt. As you certainly know, there is no such thing as a negative inference in this unconstitutional proceeding. Your letter only confirms what is known to everyone. You cannot prove your allegations against the 45th president of the United States, who is now a private citizen. The use of our Constitution to being a purported impeachment proceeding is much too serious to try to play these games. Sincerely, Bruce L. Castor, Jr., on behalf of the president. I'd like you to unpack that. I mean, I think this is a very important, succinct letter, but there's so many different issues here. The proceeding itself, is it constitutional or is it unconstitutional? I think you've basically addressed that. But how about the issue that he's now a private citizen?
Well, again, the Senate has no jurisdiction to try private citizens. That would be a bill of attainder, if nothing else, for a private citizen. But I'd simply point out that as far as calling upon him to appear and then saying that if you don't, it's going to be taken as evidence that you're guilty, which is in effect what the impeachment managers have said. First of all, by appearing, Trump would be in effect acknowledging the legitimacy of the proceeding. And that's the trick to get him to appear, because if he does so, that would acknowledge the legitimacy of it. But the second thing is that in any criminal proceeding in any court, it is made very clear that if the accused chooses not to testify, which he has a right not to do under the Fifth Amendment, that no aspersions can be made against him. And in fact, if a prosecutor were to argue in closing argument that, see, there's the defendant over there, he could have testified and he didn't, the fact that he didn't must mean he's guilty, that would be ground for reversal right there, as well as probably discipline for that attorney.
Mm.
And so the House managers, if they're trying to compare this at all to a criminal trial, they haven't the basic understanding of what due process actually is.
Senator Leahy from Vermont apparently is going to oversee this, but it's my understanding that John Roberts, Chief Justice, whose role it really would be if this were a legitimate proceeding, he said, you know, apparently he wants nothing to do with this impeachment number two.
That is correct. At least he's not going to be presiding over it. And the Constitution, of course, provides that the Vice President of the United States normally presides over proceedings of the Senate. But it said if the President is on trial for impeachment, then the Chief Justice, rather than the Vice President, will preside. Obviously, normal circumstances, Vice President will be serving with the President and would therefore have a conflict of interest in presiding. So the Constitution says that if the President is on trial, the Chief Justice will preside. Well, the point is, though, the President is not on trial right now because he is no longer President. And So that opened the question, would the person to preside be the current vice president, or would it be the president pro tem of the Senate? And they decided it to be the president pro tem of the Senate.
Okay, now this letter I read from one of Trump's attorneys is saying that essentially you guys are playing games with the U.S. Constitution, which is much too serious of a document. Playing games with the Constitution. Comment on that, if you would.
Well, that's exactly what they're doing. First of all, they are cheapening the process of impeachment, and they will feel the effects of this at a later time. If we can impeach a person simply for saying something that we didn't like, which is what the cancel culture today is all about, that can work both ways. And when the pendulum swings and when Republicans are back in power, if they adhere to the baser nature, what they'll probably try to do is find reasons to impeach every Democrat who says something they don't like. And the whole process of impeachment has been just cheapened. And I think it's significant that the impeachment that took place a year ago, that President Trump's popularity didn't seem to have been affected by that at all. And so far, his popularity hasn't been affected by this one either, despite the fact that you have all the media hype that has built this up into a major capital crime, which clearly it is not.
In the meantime, who were those people on January 6th, the ones that breached the Capitol? I don't think we know fully well yet who they were, but I would not be comfortable to say they were all Trump supporters by any means.
Well, it's been very clear there were some Antifa people among them, but then there were some who were, we call the far-right extremists, and some of these I wouldn't call conservative by any legitimate definition of the term. And the Antifa people and the far-right people, they have one thing in common. Both of them would like to see civil order break down. Both of them believe that if this nation degenerated into a civil war, that they would win the civil war and produce a pure government in accordance with their liking. So both have a common interest in trying to create disorder. But these are not the traditional conservative grassroots Trump supporters at all.
Right.
Now, many of those were there at the rally. Many of them did come over to the Capitol. And when the barricades to the Capitol were removed, and it's still not clear who removed them, it appears that some of those were removed by some of the Capitol police.
Mm-hmm.
But when those barriers were removed, some of those people probably did enter the Capitol thinking that they were entitled to do so.
Right.
If they are charged with criminal trespass, and if they can establish that they had a reasonable and good faith belief that they were being allowed to enter, they may have a defense to that charge.
Sure.
But that just kind of goes to what we see in Exodus 23, do not follow a multitude to do evil. And when you're in a crowd has no conscience. And
Excellent. So
you've got to keep your wits about you and be sure you don't do something just because others are doing it.
Yeah.
They made a mistake. It may have been a good faith mistake, but it was a mistake.
Yes. Okay, we have about a minute left. Was that passage Exodus 23, you said?
Exodus 23.
Excellent. Okay,
I'm pretty
great.
Sure that's correct.
All right. We have about a minute left. I understand you wanted to mention something about Marjorie Taylor Greene, the congressman being congresswoman being censured.
Well, we see, another low that's created here because, yes, each House has the authority to discipline its members, but I've never seen them that I know of discipline a member for something that the person said before the person even took office in Congress. And anyway, she gave an excellent press conference and speech this morning. She apologized for the things she had said earlier that she believed some things on the Internet that she discovered were not true. She had the integrity to apologize for those and retract them, something which I've never heard any of the squad in the Democrat Party ever do.
Right.
But then you go on to see what's going on with the stimulus bill right now, which is being passed by the Senate on a 50-50 vote with the vice president casting the deciding vote in favor of it. And that first raised a question in my mind, wait a minute, revenue bills have to originate in the House. Then it occurred to me, wait, this isn't even a revenue bill, this is a spending bill. And it seems like most people today, all they're concerned about is how big a check am I going to get? But there's nothing in this bill talking about who's going to pay for it, where it's going to come from. And that's all the Democrat leadership seems to be concerned about. First of all, rage, hatred toward anybody who disagrees with them and wanting to diss them, to cancel them, to suppress them, discredit them in any way they can. Secondly, pure politics, trying to get votes by spending programs that apparently are going to have to be paid for by our grandchildren and great-grandchildren, but with no consideration for who's ultimately going to pay for this or what the ultimate economic consequences are going to be. It's a party that is now crazed with power and popularity and socialist ideology, and I think they're going to reap the whirlwind from this, and people, I'm hoping, will come to their senses and realize just how badly they've been misled.
Morallaw.org for more information. John Eismo, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jerry. It's always an honor to be with you.
Okay, great. Bye-bye now.